Case is 01625, in re Joseph Ray, Jacob Austin, Nicholas James, Matthew William, and Samantha Josephine Bonfield.
Thanks, Jim.
Ms. Waterman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Sally Fry Waterman, and I represent Terry Bonfield and Shelley Zacharins. I would like to reserve 2 minutes in response to the arguments which are being advanced against my clients, although there is no appellee in this matter. Your Honors, we spend so much time punishing and searching for the parents who fail to support their children that today we ask you to help parents who wish to have those rights and, more importantly, those responsibilities imposed upon them by interpreting the definition of parent where the statute in Ohio has failed to provide that definition for the court. And unlike so many family law cases that this court hears and the trial courts hear, there is no controversy between the parties. They are in complete agreement to enter into a parenting arrangement that would serve the best interests of their 5, now 6, children. And from the perspective of the Bonfield children, Terry and Shelley are viewed by all of the children as their equal parents. There was expert medical testimony presented below by Dr. Leslie Swift, who concluded that, in his opinion, they are indeed a family, that the children view Terry and Shelley as their parents. And so we petitioned the court to recognize both of them as parents of their children for simple day-to-day reasons, such as being able to obtain medical treatment and being able to pick the children up from school. Currently, Shelley is not recognized as a parent of the children, although Dr. Swift, the medical expert, testified that she is, on a day-to-day basis, viewed by the children more as the primary caregiver.
In order to rule in your favor, wouldn't there be required a change in the definition of parent by the legislature?
I don't believe that there would, Your Honor. The legislature has chosen not to define parent within the context of the shared parenting statute. And while the legislature is certainly at liberty to view this issue and make new law,
but
it's
isn't parent defined in other places that we must follow that definition?
It is defined as it may include the biological or adoptive relationship, but it doesn't exclude the doctrine of in loco parentis. And as this court found in Lawson versus Atwood, it was appropriate under the wrongful death statute to find that although not a biological or adoptive parent, that under a certain criteria, a 4-prong test that I propose in this case, the court determined that Mr. Lawson stood in loco parentis, and therefore, although not a biological or adoptive parent, should be viewed as a parent because the child viewed him as a parent, that he provided responsible tasks for the child, and the child had lived in his home. And that's the similar test that I'm proposing to the court. Only under a different set of circumstances. There's no question that Shelley would qualify under the terms of in loco parentis. I'm asking the court to adopt a test similar, but for different reasons, as the court did in Lawson. And as to whether this would be a matter for the legislature to decide, of course I would respond that they're certainly free to do so, but this court has never shirked or shied away from the responsibility of interpreting a statute when there is a construction problem with that statute.
That's I guess the issue that I'd like us to concentrate on, because we are bound, as you know, by what the legislature has given us in statutes here. There are very persuasive arguments on both sides, mm-hmm. for public policy arguments, but unfortunately here I don't think we're constricted by what the General Assembly has said the public policy is. How do you 3111.01, how do you read that section of the code? It's a very awkward section, it seems to me. I'm not sure how we should interpret it, so I'd like to hear, you briefed it obviously, but I'd like to hear your best argument on that.
Well, my thought on that statute is that it's very vague, it's very ambiguous, and the problem is, what did the General Assembly mean to say, and any other provision of the revised code which confers or imposes rights, privileges, duties, and obligations? That's the catch-all provision that is so unclear and so ambiguous that I would ask the court to look behind the General Assembly's other areas where they have expressed their intent and their purpose, and specifically with regard to, they set forth a task force in their recent revisions to 3109.04. And that task force, some of the duties that they imposed were to, number one, put children's needs first. And then, among other things, then they go in and start to talk about the participants, that we want to encourage the participants in a controversy or a custody issue to reach out-of-court agreements. So that is their goal. They want participants, and they specifically refer to participants under 3109.40, mandating the designation of a task force.
What significance do you see in that section in the fact that in the first phrase, parent and child relationship means a legal relationship that exists between child's natural adoptive parents, which seems to be quite specific, and then in the last phrase, the parent-child relationship includes the mother and child relationship and the father and child relationship. Usually the word includes means that there can be other incidents or other factors. Do you see any significance in that wording?
I see great significance in that, because by virtue of the fact that it includes, I think it's clear that it does not necessarily then exclude.
Not limit.
Does not limit. And reading further into the next provision, which is 3111.02, they talk about a child and parent relationship that may be established. They don't say shall be established, it's may. Therefore, the interpretation of parent to include the doctrine of in loco parentis, where there are specific, very specific factors met,
Do you see any significance to 3111.01b?
Absolutely. I know that one of the arguments that has been made by Mr. Langdon is that shared parenting plans cannot be entered into between unmarried parents. And therefore, Shelley and Terry cannot do so either, because the legislature only talks about children of the marriage under 3109.04. But that is an exact contradiction to 3111.01b. Clearly, the legislature has addressed that and said, we are not going to treat children of unmarried parents any differently than children of married parents.
Counsel has
two questions.
Go ahead.
Right. I'll do mine quickly. The first one is a procedural question. Yes. The other one is substantive. The point is made by people on the other side that you didn't file a shared parenting agreement with this application, and of course the statute requires that. How do you respond to that?
Well, the brief that was submitted also acknowledged that the trial court's initial review of the matter was, I held an evidentiary hearing before the magistrate on the issue of jurisdiction. I never got to present a shared parenting plan, and have, and ask the court to make a finding that it was in the best interest of the children because they were only determining at the threshold level whether the court even had jurisdiction to look at my plan.
So your answer is that there was no reason to file a shared parenting agreement until you could determine the court was even going to accept one or hear it?
Exactly.
Okay, the substantive question then goes just to that point. Is your argument that we should, through our decision, say that trial courts have jurisdiction to hear such matters, but then it is discretionary with the trial court whether or not to grant a shared parenting agreement?
I think that that would be a very accurate statement of the
okay.
proposition of
and
law.
And if that's the case, then if the shared parenting agreement were turned down by the trial court, mm-hmm. then would it be your judgment that our test on review or a court of appeals test on review would be abuse of discretion?
Correct, Your Honor.
So it really isn't completely discretionary with the trial court, and the best interests don't come into that, and, do they?
Well, I believe in any shared parenting plan, the trial court would be required to review the plan. They must make a finding that the plan is in the best interest
of
the
children. So you accept the best interest standard on that basis. It is not a absolute per se legal right.
No.
If we would authorize it, it would be, is it in the best interest of the children?
Correct. I think every shared parenting case has to be decided on a case-by-case basis, and we could not develop a test that still wouldn't require a best interest finding, and that would be within the discretion of the trial court.
Counsel, was the petition that was originally filed in this case amended at all?
It was not amended, even despite the fact that during the proceedings, Shelley became
right.
pregnant and gave birth to another
okay.
child. Again,
the reason I asked that question is I think your portrayal of what you asked for originally is not quite accurate. And in this case, in looking at the petition, seems to me is perhaps a little less difficult than it's being made to seem. The prayer in the petition, accordingly, and I quote, the petitioners request that the court award them the legal status of custodians of the children pursuant to the agreed entry submitted herewith, which was the tendered joint custodial agreement.
Right, it would have bestowed
that,
upon.
That's not in the record, but was apparently proffered, and the trial judge discusses that. And did not the trial judge in the hearing suggest that she would be willing to entertain and felt she had the power to award joint custody? And how is that, and I read your discussion with the judge as saying, because the judge is objecting to where the word parent creeps into all of this from time to time. It crept in a lot in the discussion. And you say, I guess, and the judge is asking you why, and you say, I guess most of my experience is in domestic relations court, they'll reject a plan that uses the word custody, mm-hmm. saying that's not how the statute reads any longer. I must have to include a shared parenting plan.
Right.
And that, I assume, refers to the fact that there's been an evolution in the nomenclature, and it was a joint custody or shared custody that was in vogue 15 or 20 years ago as the adult thing to do with in a domestic relations dispute. And then someone came up with new words, a shared parenting, which sound better, mm-hmm. makes the kids sound less like property. And so that's the terms that are used in the statute now. And isn't that where some of this conflict comes in? Because 2151, that gives jurisdiction, and the Court of Appeals found that gave jurisdiction, is an old statute.
Right.
And it cross-references to the domestic relation guidance as to what all you weigh when you decide these issues.
Except that it does also require the juvenile court to exercise its jurisdiction in conjunction with 3109.04, which this court has upheld to say that is what we have to follow.
Right.
Even when the case originates in juvenile court. I think the problem that I had with petitioning as
How does custody, which the judge seems willing to award joint custody, how is that going to differ for your clients than, and in that, as I understand from the references, you're spelling out that what they're asking to do is to assign the typical parental responsibilities, which is different than saying, I'm a parent.
The parental rights and responsibilities that flow from having two people designated as parents of the children. I think the problem with captioning it as a custody plan is that the history of the case law would then suggest that Terry is somehow the unsuitable parent. And that would be contrary to the evidence that was presented and a finding that that type of arrangement would be in the best interest of the
children. The trial judge just makes the other argument to you, saying that if you get into parent, then that deprives the other parent by implication of that. But
it doesn't, because they would both have Terry is not relinquishing any of her custodial rights. She would be sharing them with.
And that's what the trial judge suggested to you.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Waterman. Mr. Langdon, representing the Amici Curiae.
May it please the court, my name is David Langdon, and I'm here on behalf of several of the Amici that have filed briefs in this action. I realize my participation here today is somewhat unusual, but nevertheless, I appreciate the court's willingness to give me the opportunity to say a few words. On behalf of Amici, we believe the court should affirm the dismissal of the appellant's petition for the following two reasons. First, as has been discussed and briefed ad nauseum, as the lower courts held, appellants lack standing under the shared parenting statute to sustain this action, as Ms. Zacharitz is not the natural or adoptive parent of the child. The second issue, and one that I want to actually focus a good majority of my time on, is an issue that I confess is not contained within my brief, but one that struck me as I was preparing for oral argument, and it's a threshold issue, and that is whether or not there is a justiciable case or controversy before this court. Ms. Waterman started off her oral argument, and I quote, stating there is no controversy between the parties. That's their position. And I think that if we look very hard at the petition in this case, at the briefing throughout this case, that it can lead to the conclusion, at least something that is worth considering, that there is no case or controversy that has been presented to this court.
Counsel, you say in your brief that you feel for their problem in one of your briefs. Well, that do you agree that there is a legal problem here that these women face?
No, I would not agree, Justice. No, and again, I think that comes to the case or controversy issue. There is no justiciable issue. They are, in essence, asking this court for an advisory opinion. If you look throughout their petition and throughout their briefs, I think there's a tacit admission in their brief to this court where they state that they're attempting to proactively secure rights.
So where do they go when there is a controversy?
I think that is would be the proper time to go into court.
And what court?
Pardon?
And what court? And what do they ask for?
Well, I think that would
depend. They split up, and the partner who has no legal rights here wants to visit the children. Where do they go? Does she go?
I think at that point there would be a justiciable case or controversy. The question would then become, we would get to the issue that's been briefed, and that would be whether there's in fact standing to bring a claim.
In the end, you say you don't have anywhere to go. if there is a dispute and there is a need.
Well, I certainly don't think that they would have a right to bring an action under the shared parenting statute. Perhaps under the court's general jurisdiction, the juvenile court's jurisdiction under 2151.23, where the court has original jurisdiction to determine custody issues, at that point you have two competing parties with adverse interests that are fighting for custody. I believe that it's possible that the court could rule upon that. Now, again, the court may find that there is no case that's being presented by the non-biological mother based on the fact that she's a non-biological mother.
But you would agree under that circumstance, the non-biological mother would have access to the court?
I think she would have access to the court, correct.
Let's test that case or controversy. That's an interesting thought, but it seems to me you're bottoming me out that there has to be an argument, some controversy between two people. Can't a citizen also have a case or controversy with its government? And here she's in a position of saying, I want to do this, and the government says no. Doesn't that put them at opposite poles of an issue that's clearly a controversy?
Yes, they're at opposite issues, but here there's no government being represented where you normally would have a prosecutor or someone there representing the government's position. In this particular instance, you don't have that. So there, again, there is no...
Well, I think we do because we have a trial judge entering an order saying no. That sure sounds like a controversy to me. They say we like it, and they say you can't have it.
Well, the trial judge is supposed to be acting in what I would consider to be a neutral position, simply in interpreting the law as it's been handed down to him by the legislature or through the courts. And so, again, I would say that the fact that, you know, there is no appellee in this case shows that there is no controversy. Ms. Waterman, admitted there's no controversy here. This would be akin to my wife and I perhaps walking into court and saying, you know, we would like you to declare that we have legal custody of our children. Well,
statute already gives you that.
Well, actually, it doesn't. If you look at the statutes, I find nothing in any of the statutes that says there is a presumption that two married couple with children have custody. All of the statutes that the Ohio General Assembly has crafted in this area of the law have been to deal with disputes when there's a divorce, for example. And that's why Revised Code 310904 is even in existence. And that's one of the arguments that we make is that statute is only applicable in the context of a divorce or an annulment proceeding or some sort of proceeding where there's two married parties. And then there needs to be, as a side issue or as a product of that proceeding, an allocation of parental rights and responsibilities.
Okay, well, if we accept that proposition, then would it be fair to say that there is no place for Terry and Sherry and people likely situated to go to resolve what they feel is a problem in their lives?
No, I think as I was indicating in my answers to the justice, that if there is a live case or controversy, a dispute between the parties, if they were to split up and come into the court,
how could it arise? Because the parent, clearly Terry's a parent, you wouldn't disagree with that, would you?
Pardon? No.
Terry is a parent. She is a parent.
The biological mother, correct.
Okay, she's a parent. So she would have the right to care, custody, and control of the children. How could you ever have a dispute arise between them that would be justiciable?
Well, because again, you have adverse parties. At that point, Ms. Zacharitz is going to come into the court and claim that as a result of having fulfilled this de facto parent-type role as alleged, I should have access to these children, whether it be custody or visitation. Again, I think if you look at all of the cases, in fact, every single case that's been briefed, and there's been a lot of cases that have been included in all of these briefs, the cases in the sister states, each of these cases involves a situation where you're dealing with a former partner. It always arises out of a dispute which is therefore then justiciable by the court.
Well, counsel, don't you then end up with the same trap that you argue prevents relief today? You come in under 2151 at a point where parties such as this have separated, and the party who's not the legal parent comes in under 2151, as you suggest, would be the right of access. And I think your answer there is correct. It has to be, or you fly in the face of the Bill of Rights, Article 1, Section 16, the right to redress in courts. So you come in under 2151, and then you're still faced with that cross-reference over to the Chapter 31, which is all couched in terms of parents and in terms of divorce, dissolution, those kinds of things, which you cannot have in their circumstance. So, I mean, aren't you just in a trap then, just as you suggest now?
Perhaps that may be the case, but, you know, I submit that that's all perspective and speculative. That's not an issue before the court.
But it's an everyday issue. It's already happened. We have this Franklin County case in which they turned away people with the real controversy. Same result. You come in under 2151 and then cross-reference. And wasn't the change in 31 just designed to put in new nomenclature, really not thinking about this kind of an issue? That is the shared parenting. That's an evolution from shared custody, is it not?
I agree.
Okay. And the legislature there was principally thinking about a better term, a better way to describe what's going on in resolving those controversies. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that's certainly reasonable to presume on their part. But, you know, nevertheless, they stated what they stated, and 310904 reads in the context of in a divorce or legal separation or annulment proceeding.
So I think what Justice Douglas and I am both asking is where's the meaningful access to the courts for people in this situation?
I think that it would be under 2151.23, where the juvenile court has exclusive original jurisdiction to hear all matters, all disputes, justiciable disputes involving custody.
Well, let's assume under 310904, a male and female who are married and have children submit to the trial court a plan for shared parenting. The trial court, in an apparent clear abuse of her discretion, denies the plan. The parents cannot appeal that decision?
If I understand you correctly, a married couple goes in and asks for a shared parenting?
Yeah.
It would be,
no case or no controversy. I'm going back to your suggestion that there has to be a case or controversy here before a court's jurisdiction can be invoked. What about probate court, where there's the probate of a will and nobody challenges except the person who is affected by the judgment of the probate court? The person says, I don't agree with you, probate court. There's nobody on the other side opposing or doing anything, but the person is a legatee or whatever, and the probate court makes a mistake. No appeal because there's nobody on their side to argue with or dispute with? That's not the law, is it?
In the context of the probate court, and I will confess that I don't do any probate type work, but I believe that there can be a distinction that can be drawn in the context of probate and perhaps the context here. I think that here, the purpose, the underlying purpose, the legislative intent of the shared parenting statutes of Chapter 31 is to deal with disputes that arise out of the allocation of children. The appellants admit in their petition that they both have custody of the children. I mean, that's not in dispute. They live there with the children. They both take care of them. Clearly, there's not a dispute.
But one of them doesn't have the right to get medical records or medical treatment, et cetera.
Well, I certainly think that she could have that right through a simple power of attorney, or power, you know, durable power of attorney of health care. There's a variety of different ways that, you know, they can obtain those rights, which would apply to school, which would...
Short of shared parenting.
Yes, I would say that.
You're suggesting that, the term, the words, and any proceeding pertaining to the allocation of parental rights and responsibilities is confined to instances where there's a dispute. It has to be a dispute before the court's jury. Why? That doesn't say that, though, does it? And any proceeding pertaining to the allocation of parental rights. Parties, people come to the court and say, we want to allocate parental rights. But we're not in dispute about it. That doesn't say there has to be a dispute, does it?
No, and I'm not basing my argument on 3109. I'm basing it on the Ohio Constitution and the requirement that courts of common pleas only hear justiciable issues. And certainly the juvenile court is a sub-court of the Court of Common Pleas. And because, you know, as a public policy matter, we certainly don't want to encourage folks without a dispute to simply come into court and ask the court to render an advisory opinion. Tell me what my rights are in this particular case.
Well, the opinion here in this case really would not be advisory, would it? I mean, if Judge Hendon had allocated the parental rights as requested, that would not be advisory. That would be advisory?
In my opinion, it would be, because nothing would change with respect to the parties. The day they walk into court, they both have custody of the children. The day they argue, the day they brief, and after the decision is rendered, nothing has changed.
Both don't have legal custody of the children. Only one.
Well, I would submit that, you know, it's difficult to distinguish between factual custody and legal custody.
But there are so many things that without legal custody, a person cannot do with the child. That's the problem. If Judge Hendon had granted the shared parenting, the situation would be different.
May I respond?
Certainly. Yes.
I would submit that the biological parent certainly has legal custody, or at least it's presumed that she has legal custody, and that as long as she is freely giving, you know, sharing that custody with a third party, with someone else, that there is no dispute as to whether or not she has legal custody until the non-biological mother is denied some sort of right. For example, she's denied the ability to pick them up from school, or she's denied this or that. At that point, you then have a live case or controversy where they could come into court and they could say, look, you know, there is a legitimate dispute here as to whether or not she is a parent or she has custody, and we'd like this court to decide, you know, these adverse interests in one way or the other. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Langdon. Ms. Waterman, you've used your time, but you may take a minute.
Thank you. Just briefly, Your Honors, with regard to there not being any controversy, I meant that in terms of they were in agreement to enter into a shared parenting plan, just as petitioners who are married and petition the court for a dissolution of their marriage are in agreement, and they submit a shared parenting plan. There's no controversy between
counsel,
them.
Counsel, I would have liked to ask the amicus this, because he raises the Troxell case.
Yes.
And he says that the appellant's fundamental rights here aren't violated. They're protected by the shared parenting statute. And I'm curious in what way. It seems to me the Troxell case, it helps you, doesn't it?
I believe I also
or your
cited,
clients, I mean.
Yes, I cited the Troxell case in my brief as well, in support of Terry's fundamental right to direct the upbringing of her children can and should include the right to share that fundamental right and those fundamental responsibilities with the person who stands in loco parentis to the children, that being Shelley. And so I agree that Troxell does support them. It also has a unique set of circumstances and a finding by our U.S. Supreme Court that, hey, we need to recognize that the traditional American family is no longer mom, dad, and children. It is everything from an unmarried couple to then a father who commits suicide, those are the facts in Troxell, to now a step-parent who then becomes a parent because he adopted. That's what Troxell also speaks to, I believe, to this court, that this is the traditional American family is changing every day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Waterman. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.